Hey everyone, we're live with our newest episode of The Conversation. I am your host, Elisha Krause, and our very own Michael Knowles will be taking live questions for an entire hour. Don't forget, and please remember that our conversation is live for everyone to watch. We're equal opportunity watchers around here, but you can only be a part of it if you are a subscriber to The Daily Wire. Subscribe to dailywire.com right now and join us. Be sure to tune in for the next month's episode on Tuesday, June 19th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific for, drumroll, our editor-in-chief and co-founder, the very great Ben Shapiro. The big boss himself. On that day of The Conversation, you will probably not be here, though. Where might you be?
I think I'll be fired by that point.
Oh, no. I meant, like, are you going to be on your honeymoon
then? Oh, yeah, that too.
Because, it's kind of an important date that's around the corner.
Oh, I told Ben was really nice because he said that I could, I could take a week off for a honeymoon or 2 weeks off or never come back, actually, which is really, most bosses, they try to limit you.
I don't think
really
that
good.
He meant paid, though. You could take as much time off as you want.
Well, we'll have to look into the exact details of it.
By the way,
I have to tell you, you can probably hear how I'm sounding right now.
Yes.
I literally have gotten sick and tired of winning. There has been so much winning in the last 2 weeks. I think I have a sinus infection.
And the leftist tears don't help you clean out
the
sinus
cold.
They're
good, yeah. But you sip them, you shoot them up your nostrils. Yeah, it's really good. The saline of those John Kerry tears is perfect.
Oh, man. John Kerry, right? Wow, there's going to be so much to talk about today. I'm excited to see what our subscribers send in for questions.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be real good for an entire hour, folks. So
very covfefe.
God help us
all.
Lots
of covfefe.
We have our first one.
We do. Okay.
Let's get rolling. Spencer says, oh, soon to be married bachelor Michael Knowles, can you please confirm or deny for us that you will be a guest on Ben Shapiro's new Sunday special?
Well, I'm definitely going to go on it when I just walk into the room. I don't think I'll be a guest. Like, I don't think I'm welcome on it. You know, I have gotten a number of tweets about this because the Ben Sunday special has been going very well.
Yeah.
People are watching it. It's really good. It looks super cool.
Yeah.
Great guests.
The studio is so beautiful.
Yeah. So they've been now tweeting at me, and I think mostly to irritate him, and saying, you got to get Knowles on. So I'll probably just pop in there at some point, just like duck my head in.
It'll be like Jonah Goldberg, and Michael's like, oh, hey. Yeah.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Yep. What's happening? This question is from Joel. He says, we meet again, Mr. Knowles. As a former bachelor, any advice on how to get out of the friend zone? Mm. Ooh, I've never dated before, and my parents met in an arranged marriage. Also, thoughts on incels.
On incels? I don't know what are incels?
The incels are the people that are like celibate by, right?
Oh, yes.
Isn't that
I've heard about this.
Involuntary celibacy.
Involuntary, not celibacy
by choice. That would have been
Yeah, more. Well, but, yeah. I mean, I've been involuntarily celibate at various points of my life, so it's too bad.
But I mean, that's kind of a big challenge, going from a culture and a family that there was an arranged marriage to...
That is, and how to get out of the friend zone. The friend zone is really tough. Uh-huh. You know, you like this girl.
Oh, I'm a girl. I put dudes in the
friend zone. You put a dozen men in the friend zone. Right, or more. the way that you do it, always the answer about this is confidence. Now, it's very easy to say that because people say, be confident. You say, I'm not confident. That's why I'm talking to you. If I were confident, I wouldn't need to ask you this question. So you have to be confident. Mm-hmm. But as with all things, you have to be interested in the girl. Genuinely interested.
Okay.
Not just interested, even the phrase incel or involuntary celibacy, that puts all of the focus on your own dilemma, so to speak. So what you really have to do is say, I like this girl. Why do you like this girl? Because she's this, she has this, I like this about her, right? Well, what am I going to do about it? I'm going to go ask her out. Well, but what if she says no? Well, okay,
can
then
I
you
offer
find
some
girl.
Advice? Maybe when you ask her out, tell her all the things you like about her.
Yeah, well, like, okay. This gets to a couple competing theories. Not to mansplain this to you,
please,
I will say,
please do.
When guys are a little too nice, women don't always love it.
No, I'm not saying to be like a sissy man, but I'm saying be honest.
Yes,
be honest, and be manly and direct, because sissy men are not manly and direct. Women like to be pursued, and they want a man to be direct.
That's right. That is such an important point. Harvey Mansfield wrote a good book. Mm-hmm. His name is Mansfield, and it's on manliness and on how manliness has been lost.
Uh-huh.
So what you want to do to be manly is be honest, be direct, be forthright, don't be afraid, and don't try to be one of these slick guy pickup artist types either. Those are two sides of the same coin.
Yep.
You want to be a gentleman, you want to know what you want, be assertive, but not some knuckle dragger or something. Be a man, be an old school man. I have found, look, I managed to nab sweet little Elisa.
I mean, not yet.
Not yet. She still has a little while to run away, right? Yeah. But have an Elisa-shaped hole in the wall. But I think women are starved for that because mm-hmm. we live in a society of soy boys today. Mm-hmm. And all of these men who are like, hey, you up? Hey, you want a Netflix and chill?
Or you know. They're like, I've heard from single girlfriends, they'll like your Instagram post, but then when they see you in person, they won't talk to you. What is that?
Well, I just poke on Facebook. That's how I got sweet little Elisa. So you want to do? You don't want to be one of those little guys like that. You know,
yeah.
Do you want, you just be direct. I think women are starved for that.
Don't ever make that noise again.
You know, that's, listen, you know, New York, I've been around very liberal places in my life. That's all you ever hear. Uh-huh. You know? So just be direct. And to quote Don Corleone speaking to Johnny Fontaine, when he says, I don't know what to do, Godfather, he goes, you're going to act like a man. What's the matter with you? That's the answer.
Well, and then once you like it and you put a ring on it, yeah. You should get Boll & Branch.
Boll & Branch. You have got to get Boll & Branch. Boll & Branch sheets are the greatest sheets I've ever used. Look, people aren't always going to agree on everything. What we can agree is that we could all use more sleep. I only got 18 hours last night. I didn't even get my requisite 22 hours of sleep. Yeah. So Boll & Branch, always in my whole life, I would buy just the cheapest little sheets you could get, and they were $20 at the store or whatever, and they felt terrible. I didn't realize how good sheets can be. You can get sheets that are like these really high quality, the kind of sheets that they give you in the clouds when you're floating, you know, and sipping covfefe. Those sheets can cost up to $1,000 at retail stores. That's why you've got to check out Boll & Branch. Everything that Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton. It means they start out super soft, and they get even softer over time. You buy directly from them, so you're paying wholesale prices. Instead of paying $1,000 for luxury sheets, you're buying Boll & Branch sheets for only a couple $100. Everybody who tries them loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews. Forbes, Wall Street Journal, Fast Company, they're all talking about Boll & Branch. Even 3 U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. 3 U.S. presidents and one author of a blank book. Shipping is free. You can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. I know you. You're probably out there lying in the gutter saying, if only I had any sheets to use. So you get them for 30 nights free. Try them out. There's no reason not to. To get started, right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets. Go to bollandbranch.com, promo code Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, bollandbranch.com. Today for $50 off your first set of sheets, B-O-L-L and branch.com, promo code Michael. How many times I got to say this? Bollandbranch.com, promo code Michael. They're really good. You will not regret it. It is so nice. I look forward to sleeping now even more than I used to, which was a lot.
That 18 hours a day, I just want to smack you across
the face. It's needed. Look, this doesn't just happen, folks. All right? This doesn't just... You got to get a lot of beauty sleep.
Well, when you're up all night with a teething 9-month-old, this happens after Jess spends an hour and a half on you in hair and makeup. Yago has a question.
All right, Yago.
All right. This is your future, by the way.
This is,
like,
yeah.
Children, marriage. Aren't you so excited?
I don't know. I might have some running around out there right now for all I know. I don't.
Oh, God. Do you guys cover that in pre-canon? Yago says, hey, Michael, who do you think will outlast the other? Do you think Trump will make it to 8 years, or will the media and the left succeed in pushing him out?
Well, it seems like they really want to impeach the guy. They've been trying to
impeach. Nancy Pelosi joked about that yesterday.
Yeah, they all really want to impeach the guy. I think he's going to stick it out. I think the one thing you can never say with Trump is never, which is ironic because there was a whole movement called Never Trump. The guy seems to outfox his opponents at mm-hmm. every step of the way. The other reason why I think he'll outlast them is that the American people like him. He's very popular right now. His approval rating has consistently been on par with Obama's at this point in mm-hmm. his presidency or higher. We know that approval of his presidency, especially among millennials, especially among racial minorities, has surged in just the last 5 months. We know just among black men, it doubled overnight, and actually even more than doubled because the mixed feelings percentage also rose significantly. Mm-hmm. So I think he's doing very well on that front. Obviously, the facts of his presidency are all looking good. The economy is doing well. We're seeing good diplomacy, freed hostages, on and on and on. This also shows that successful presidencies shape public opinion. So look, the left and the Democrats and the resistance and all the screaming people and the pink hats who say no, you know, all of those people still want to impeach him. I say let them try, because if they succeed, if they manage to impeach him, you could probably see what happened to Nixon in 1974. Mm. Nixon was elected in 1972 with 49 states. 49 states, he lost one state, just a few electoral votes that he lost. They finally booted him out of office like they wanted to. What happened? The next big election, we got Ronald Reagan, we got 28 years of basically conservative governance. So the mainstream media, the Democratic Party, bureaucrats, they can try to overturn a presidential election. The people still have a say, and I think that they will make their voice heard.
Okay, it'll be interesting, especially with the midterms coming up.
The data from the midterms are incredible, mm-hmm. because historically, he should lose the House, mm-hmm. if not the House and the Senate.
Most sitting presidents do lose midterm elections.
That's just the historical mm-hmm. record. And yet the numbers that we're seeing, a lot of people now are saying, hold off on this blue wave. A lot of Democratic strategists mm-hmm. are saying, this blue wave might not be as nice as we thought. Some people are saying we could pick up seats in the Senate. If we manage not to lose the House, which we should lose the House, historically speaking, if we manage not to, that would be a massive mandate to govern. It would be unexpected, except by all the people who expected it.
Like you.
Like me.
All right. Hide the grin for a little bit. Jacob says, I've read before that Muhammad is a descendant of Ishmael. If true, is Islam what the Bible speaks of in Genesis 16:12? Quote, he will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand will be against him, and he will live to the east of all of his brothers.
Well, the trouble with prophecy is that you can read a lot of things into it. Certainly, Islam does trace its lineage to Ishmael, so you see historical parallels there. But when you're looking at the Quran for historical accuracy, I think you're probably not doing very well. There are probably better places for the historical record, because it says very clearly in the Quran, they crucified him not with regard to Jesus. They say that they didn't crucify Jesus, that it looked like they were crucifying him. There's a lot of commentary on this. They say he was taken off at the last minute, or someone was substituted in for him. But the denial of the cross of Christ is a central historical fact of Islam. And St. Paul writes, there are many walking now, and I tell you, even weeping, who deny the cross of Christ. And they deny it because the cross conquers death. Christ on the cross conquers death. This is the central theological fact of our civilization, and it's one that everybody has to grapple with. So the traditional Christian view of Islam is that it's a heresy, a Christian heresy. We know that Muhammad developed his religion when he was with a heretical Christian monk in Syria on a merchant trip with his uncle. That change could be read through the Bible very easily. And the Bible, as the beginning of wisdom, would tell us a lot about this. But looking at Islam, looking at those strange historical claims such as the claim from Ishmael, claims such as the cross of Christ, I think tell you a lot about the religion itself and how it relates to the modern era, how civilization has grown up alongside it.
All right, let's keep moving. Nicholas says, Michael, does Jesus ask that a Christian forgives only people that have asked forgiveness as God does, or to forgive regardless of them being repentant?
Well, you forgive people. You mm-hmm. should forgive. You say in the Lord's Prayer, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive the
Michael
trespasses
Knowles
of
for
others.
Trespassing
yes, as we forgive Michael, yeah. So you're asking for forgiveness from God the Father mm-hmm. only in so much as you are forgiving other people. Now, this is not to say, however, that there's no role for human freedom here. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about Christian heresies. So one thing I notice about heresy is that it always cannot stand, it cannot tolerate theological mystery, divine mm-hmm. mystery. So God is fully just and he's fully merciful. How do we make sense of this? Those things seem to be at odds, but what is impossible for man is not impossible for God. Some heresies want to say it's all justice, no mercy. Some want to say it's all mercy, no justice. Some versions of Christianity say that there is only God's grace, and humans' liberty has nothing to do with it. Free will has nothing to do with it. Another heresy, called the Pelagian heresy, says that it's only free will that matters and God's grace is not the central fact. But of course, the reality is that it's both. So should you forgive? Yes, you should forgive. But this is not to say that your free will doesn't play a part. God comes down the mountain, but then you have the liberty to turn toward God or to turn away from God. If not, the faith would be for naught. You see it most specifically with the Virgin Mary. The angel Gabriel comes down and says, Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. You're going to conceive a child and, so on and so forth. And she says, I am the servant of the Lord, his will be done. Mm-hmm. And all of heaven is waiting, and she ascends to it. That freedom is so essential. And as we were talking about the way that religion affects culture and affects civilization, that centrality of human liberty tells us a lot about our civilization. I think we know that. We live in a free society, and
so,
that's why.
My evangelical mind went to when I was a child, and I asked my mom the gist of that same question, and she used the 70 times 7 thing. And then, like, every kid has done the 70 times 7 when they have
right.
to think of how they have to forgive their sister for pulling their hair or something. But I think that was an eloquent way of putting it.
That is.
Lots of theology questions today. Let's see if some politics questions come up. Joel says, as a staunch populist nationalist, thoughts on international media such as Bollywood movies, Japanese anime, etc., can media created outside of the United States borders be good and compete against Hollywood?
Yeah, I like foreign films. Mm-hmm. I like Bollywood well enough. It's not that I consume it all the time. If I'm on an airplane, that's usually the only time. I say, oh, that's kind of weird. I don't watch Bollywood movies too much. I do watch a lot of foreign films from Russia or Italy or Germany or something.
Of course,
in the Western world, obviously Russia. It's important because before I go in to collude with people, mm-hmm. I like to know a little bit about their popular culture.
That's a good idea, especially since I'm sure most of the Russian films are funded by Putin-loving oligarchs.
Right, that's right, yeah. You know, the one today that was in the news, his name is Oleg. His name is actually short for oligarch. Anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Oleg the oligarch?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I do love, though, because obviously Hollywood turns out a bunch of tripe. And the movies have gotten worse. The only area of Hollywood that's gotten better is television, where a lot of the good stories have moved.
Streaming services
have really enabled that. I strongly advise watching foreign films and foreign television shows, because the way that Hollywood can manipulate your mind is it knows it has a lock on you. It knows that if you're in the popular culture in the United States, you're watching them, you're like plugged in with an electrode into your brain. And so they're gonna send you messages. And when you read literature from around the world, you read or you watch films from around the world or television or radio, it opens up your mind and it shifts your consciousness. And you say, to quote Kanye West, it shifts the consciousness. And you say, oh, there's another way of looking at the world. Oh, there's another vision that maybe I don't have from popular culture. It's really good. And one of the great advantages of it is it allows you to criticize your own popular culture in the United States. It really puts you ahead. So I strongly advise it. Watching subtitles can be tedious, but it's worth doing.
Interesting. So we have a very fancy watch that you're wearing. Are you going to wear that on your wedding day?
I certainly should. I can wear it with both black and brown. I kid you not, I get compliments on this watch all the time.
It's a really nice watch.
It is a super cool watch.
Especially the band is really nice.
So this is the Revolver series. By the way, if you're looking to get me a wedding present, they just came out with the Bronze Age collection, and they have the Bronze Age Revolver. If you sent me one, I would wear it. I'm saying I would wear it. That's okay. I love their product.
Okay.
Movement is so good. A movement has come very far from being crowdfunded kids working out of a living room. In the past year, they've not only introduced a ton of new watch collections for both men and women, they've also expanded to sunglasses, which I wear, and fashion-forward bracelets for her, which I wear when, you know, she goes to sleep at night and I just want to see how I look. Maybe I look good. Movement watches start at just $95. At a department store, you would pay $300-$500 to get a watch of this quality, seriously. Movement figured out that by selling online, they would be able to cut out that middleman and the retail markup. They would provide the best possible price. So you get classic design, a minimalist style, very high quality construction. Today, don't say I never did nothing for you. I'm giving you a wedding present, even though it's my wedding. Get 15% off today with free shipping and free returns. Go to mvmt.com/covfefe. COVFEFE. See why Movement keeps growing. Check out their expanding collection, movement.com, mvmt.com/covfefe, COVFEFE. Join the movement.
I feel like COVFEFE is very like hooked on phonics, work for me. It's all I can think of when you spell that out. Megan says, hi, Michael, who do you support for California governor?
I don't know, sweet meteor of death. Is that an option? I mean,
that was the option for president in 2016.
That was, yeah. Actually, it turned out pretty well. I'm glad Sweet Meteor didn't win in 2016. Maybe we'll get a chance.
So I'm the nerd that reads through all of the candidates and their statements.
I did it last night.
Hilarious.
Who'd you vote for?
I haven't voted yet.
Okay.
I am the weird person that a lot of my friends do absentee, but I like to go to the polling place.
What?
And I like to bring my daughters, and I like to, you know, yeah, I'm weird.
I wouldn't ever allow anybody near the
place.
You know, you get the
check
craziest
things out. Make sure they're, sticking to the rules.
It is in 2016.
Because I have been given a Democratic ballot before, like on primary day.
I
was like, excuse me,
In 2016, I went in there. I had my Republican Party emblem shorts on. I was walk down the street.
Of course you did.
I had voted in the primary. Uh-huh. And they couldn't find my registration for the general election. This happened to several Republican friends of mine in California. Not surprising. So we have one candidate that I guess is sort of running a campaign, Travis Allen.
Mm-hmm.
He's mounting something of a campaign.
Is it going to end up being like Gavin Newsom, though?
Yeah.
It's going to be Gavin Newsom.
It's going to be Gavin Newsom.
Have you seen his ads?
Just horrific. I mean, you know, it's really sad because the most conservative figure in California politics practically is Governor Moonbeam, just because he's old. So he actually, Governor Moonbeam was actually vetoed some of the gunpocalypse legislation. It's really a terrible.
I don't know, but he's on the environment and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And business stuff.
He's a hippy-dippy space alien.
Yeah.
It's really sad, though, because we're in a bad place right now politically, and we're going into a worse place politically. So I strongly endorse Sweet Meteor of Death for the California political races.
I have to say, I think that more so than governor, the local races are where we potentially stand a chance. So
yeah.
Pay attention to those. That's your mom advice of the day. Christian says, will you place another bet against Ben for the midterm elections? And if so, will you write another blank book with it?
So for those who don't know, I have it somewhere in the studio here. I won $400 from Mr. Shapiro.
Check's
right
there. Yep.
I won $400 from Mr. Shapiro for the 2016 election. I bet on Trump. He bet against Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the reason I won so much money is that Ben gave me odds. So he gave me 4-1 odds on this bet. Ben has now told me, because he didn't just lose against me in that election. He lost a few bets.
Yeah.
He's told me he will never again give odds on a bet. So I don't know. If I just get even odds, I don't know if I want to be that much of a gambling
man. Did you donate
man.
The money to charity or something?
Yeah, I donated it to something, all right. Is that the cigar store across the street, is that a charity?
I don't think
Are they a 501c3 yet? Or?
I mean, if now we view capitalism as a charity.
Yeah, that it was pretty good. I guess it's really, Ben, giving me that check is a charity because he hasn't paid me since then.
Oh.
So that's sort of a charity.
Well, that's a relief. All right. I hope I'm saying this right. Doty?
It looks like Doty.
That's right. Doty? It looks like the Democrats are losing some ground. So do you think that this will last or is this Trump's only term?
They are losing ground. Mm-hmm. We are winning. I cannot say this emphatically enough. We, against all odds, shockingly, we are winning. We're winning on every level because the presidency thus far has been successful as a matter of judicial appointments, as a matter of other appointments, the economy, foreign policy, deregulation. It's just a success so far. It's successful in the popular culture. It's because, as Andrew Breitbart said, politics is downstream of culture. We elected a cultural figure. And surprise, surprise, he's changing the culture. The biggest pop culture star in music, Kanye West, has come out and endorsed the president. He wore the MAGA hat. You had another rapper, Chance the Rapper, who actually doesn't support Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And he said black people don't have to vote for Democrats. You're seeing this major cultural shift as well. So this is obviously a success. What does this mean for Democrats in the future? Politics has never settled. There are not permanent answers in politics. It's not philosophy. It's not theology. Politics, as Aristotle defines it, is the affairs of men. Those go back and forth. So eventually, some Democrat probably will win something at some point. I will point out, the only people they have especially California, the only people they have are just old white people.
They really are.
They just have Hillary, Pocahontas. Is she white? I don't know. You've got Joe Biden. Bernie Sanders is like 500 years old.
Nancy Pelosi
has been dead for 20 years, I think.
Dianne Feinstein.
Oh my gosh. I mean, yeah, those, especially in California. So they just do not have the claim to the future. They're not exciting. Hmm. People don't want to keep that reality show going. They want to watch this reality show, the Make America Great Again reality show. For the near future, I think we're winning. Could that change in a second? Sure. But as of right now, despite the constant negative press, Covfefe.
Austin says, Supreme Admiral Knowles. Well, people are giving you the weird names like Clavin.
They're using my correct titles, yes.
Oh, okay. How do you think the Iran versus Israel conflict will be ultimately resolved?
Probably with bombs, if I had to guess. No, I don't know.
From which side?
First of all, I don't know that it will be ultimately resolved because we're talking about antagonisms that go back thousands of years.
Yeah.
And certainly over 1,000 years.
I can help you out here. When Jesus returns.
That's right. Yeah, I suppose that's, yeah, in the next age, in the coming age is how that will be resolved. But I will say, also, in one of my observations of this administration's success, unlike the previous administration, which basically abandoned our ally Israel and gave the mullahs in Iran everything that they want and bent over backwards for every despot and tin pot dictator around the world. This administration has come out and said, we are not going to play by the old rules. We're going to be unpredictable. They said to the North Korean dictator, hey, you're short and you're fat. I have a big button on my desk that could blow you up at any second. You've got to worry about the madman in America. I mean, that is some really...
It wasn't just the big button. It was my button's bigger than your button.
My button's bigger than your button, and it works.
Let's remember the elementary type.
That's right. And, you know, the foreign policy establishment has told us for so long, you have to play within these parameters. You have to do. And what has it gotten us? A lot of failure. This administration comes in and says, bull in a china shop. I am going to threaten you like a wild man on Twitter. And it seems to have worked. We're now defending our ally, Israel. Israel is writing God bless Donald Trump on the walls of Jerusalem and dedicating train stations to him. And our... adversaries such as Iran, which is the single greatest threat to the world order for the past foreseeable decades, is now on notice. And so they're going to threaten to hurl some missiles from Syria or whatever, but I think that's easily rebuffed. There's only one guaranteed way you can have peace, to quote Ronald Reagan, and you can have it in the next second, which is surrender. Short of surrender, short of chains and slavery, the way that you can push for peace, the way that you can try to secure peace, is from strength. When you have strength, you might have peace. If you offer weakness, you'll get nothing but chaos and war.
All right, let's keep moving. I wonder if this has been like our very own Ben Shapiro. We'll see depending on how.
Dear Michael, you're fired. So I think it might be, actually. Yeah.
Ben says, Michael, why do people say I appeared radical crazy because I had an American flag displayed on my social media profile photo? I feel like that's a trend I've been seeing. Anything pro-America is bad.
You're crazy. You're an awful bigot. How dare you? How dare you put that hateful symbol of freedom and justice and equality and prosperity and charity? How awful of you. This is a real trend.
Is the American flag like the new Confederate flag?
Yes. They, at the University of Irvine, UC Irvine.
Well, they do lots of dumb stuff down there.
They do a lot. They voted in the student government to ban the American flag because it's not inclusive enough. And you might say, well, this is insane. America is the only country in the world that it was ever founded to be inclusive, right? To be founded primarily as a creed in this new world that the Europeans discovered, and to bring in people of all colors and races, and but all behind an American creed, one that believes in natural rights, that come from natural law, that worships a God. So I think this gets to what G.K. Chesterton wrote about in Orthodoxy. He said, there is a thought that stops thought, and that's the only thought that ought to be stopped. And that's what you're seeing when people say the American flag is awful. Because when they oppose the American flag, when Colin Kaepernick gets on a knee and protests against the American flag, he's undercutting his own protest. If you use the rights and the freedoms given to you by America to fight against America, you're a house divided against itself. You're not making any sense. That's incoherent. I don't think people quite understand that. You can, some people say, well, you support free speech, so I'm going to use my free speech to shout you down and shut you up. That is not a coherent statement. You can't use the right to undercut the right itself. You see this with people, and it's because they're not thinking very clearly. So on the left now, you get shout your abortion. You get screaming and yelling. There's no civil discourse. And the only way that I think we can deal with these people to try to turn that culture, because there is this cultural movement happening, we have to treat them like children. Because they just don't understand. They don't understand what America stands for. They don't understand why what they're saying is not coherent. So I'm not saying you need to punch them in the face. That's not what a good parent does to her child or something. You treat them like a child. You have patience. You want them to grow up. You want them to be mature, these little lefties. And maybe they'll come to realize that to protest against the American flag is a senseless and ridiculous act.
All right. Tony says, what do you think the chances are that the Republicans keep control of the House this November?
I am loath to make a prediction on this, not because I'm afraid of being wrong in politics. I've made plenty of wrong predictions in politics. It's because secretly I think that the chances are significant. I don't know if it's likely, but I think there is a significant chance Republicans keep the House. But I don't want to say that because I want people to be afraid that we will lose the House, so they go out and vote.
Yeah.
Republicans,
Well, statistically, Republicans do turn up in good numbers in midterm elections.
That is true.
General elections where Democrats have higher, you know.
That's absolutely right. Republicans are
better citizens.
We're
the nerds that have worked on campaigns before.
That is
true,
yeah.
So we know all these random stats about P1 voters.
But you do, I mean, it is true. Republicans are more civically engaged. Mm-hmm. And so they're... If I were a gambling man, I mean, you'll have to check Ben's bank account in November. But I think there's a very good likelihood that we hold the House. But not only should Republicans not be confident about this, they should be terrified because this could all end tomorrow. All of this great Covfefe MAGA stuff could end tomorrow, and it's historically likely to end. Hmm. But it's really hard to look at all of the public opinion polling that we're seeing and just all of the facts of legislation, policy, diplomacy, popular culture. It's hard to look at all of that and say that Republicans are down and out. On the contrary, I think everything is moving in our direction. And if Republicans get out and vote, I think there's a good chance that we give ourselves a mandate to govern.
Okay. Please remember that this conversation with our very own Michael Knowles is live for everyone to watch, but you can only be a part of it and ask Michael questions if you are a subscriber. So head over to dailywire.com right now and you can join us by asking us questions there. And next month, be sure to tune in for our episode on Tuesday, June 19th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, featuring our editor-in-chief, you know, host of the Ben Shapiro Show, host of the Sunday Show. I mean, he's
soon
just
to be host of the Michael Knowles Show, I think.
No, I have dibs on that.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Ben Shapiro and I will be sitting down for Ben's episode of The Conversation. So let's keep moving on. We are about halfway there, and we want to get through as many questions as possible.
All right.
Brady says, hey, Michael, whenever the left is told that the Democratic Party is the party of slavery, they just claim that the party switched. John Legend did this on Twitter, you know, when he and Kanye were going back and forth, right? What actually happened?
Oh, no, I think you remember what happened, because this is what the Democrats told me happened. So the Democrats were this awful party that was the party of slavery, the party of the Ku Klux Klan, the party that when we freed all of their slaves, when the Republican Party was founded to free their slaves, then they instituted Jim Crow and they tried to deprive black Americans of all of their rights and they tried to harm them and threaten them and lynch them. But then here's what happened according to this theory. One day they just switched just cause. They all met up.
The goodness of their hearts.
They came, they said, we're going to have lunch. The Democrats and the Republicans had lunch. They're like, okay, so from now on, you're going to be us and we're going to be you, okay? They said, oh, that sounds reasonable. Okay, cheers, you know, and that's what happened. That's what the Democrats want you to believe happened. And it is the stupidest idea I've ever heard in American politics. But people believe this. Now, why do they get away with it? In part, it's because certain geographic areas have switched political allegiances. In part, it's because the Democratic Party has embraced the left. During the 20th century, many facets of democratic activism were infiltrated by communist Soviet influence. And so you had the New Left, you had Students for Democratic Society, you had the Weather Underground. You had a lot of this moving in and infiltrating the Democratic Party. You saw certain racial groups move away. So beginning after the New Deal, black voters tended to move from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. This is not because they switched in the 1960s. That move over actually predates any civil rights legislation by several decades. You also see Republicans as the party of civil rights. They proposed the first civil rights bill, 1957, I think it was, and then Republicans voted in higher proportion for the civil rights bills in the 1960s. So where do they get this idea from? They get this idea because Democrats today are ashamed of the awful heritage of their party. The Republican Party literally founded to free the slaves, and the first presidential nominee of the Republican Party was James Fremont, as in one of those wonderful bits of historical coincidence or providence. And they're ashamed of that, and because they're lightly educated on history. So they say, well, I don't support that, and so, okay, let's just say it changed. But it's totally incoherent. As with all things in politics, there are a lot of factors moving along. When the Democratic Party moved very far to the left, a lot of those social conservatives that they once had in the South and the Bible Belt, they said, well, we can't embrace atheism, we can't embrace abortion, we can't embrace these far left social policies. And so they started to migrate more to the Republican Party. It has absolutely nothing to do with parties switching, and anyone If you believe that, I got a beautiful bridge to sell you in Brooklyn.
Kate says, where did you receive your unusually robust Catholic theology education?
Thank you for calling it unusually robust. I actually worry that it isn't very robust at all, or not as robust as it should be.
Behind the scenes, sometimes Michael studies up on Catholicism.
I do all the time, constantly.
Before the conversation.
Oh, yeah. So I'm going to get all these theological questions. The things that really help are, the first guy I'm going to recommend is actually a Protestant, but he's like a crypto-Catholic, is C.S. Lewis, almost a Catholic. So I love reading Lewis or Chesterton, or Hilaire Belloc is a particularly good Catholic writer. But if you have simple questions about Catholicism, because a lot of times you'll hear people of other Christian denominations and sects say, well, I can't believe you're a Catholic. Catholics worship saints and worship Mary and believe in justification through works, or whatever nonsense they start saying. And I realize that a lot of people don't disagree with the Catholic faith and don't attack the Catholic faith. They attack a ridiculous caricature that someone wrote of the Catholic faith that has nothing to do with Catholic dogma and Catholic tradition and history. So they'll say, well, my church reads the Bible. And I tell them my church wrote the Bible, so there's a little difference there. But one wonderful resource for this is there's a website called Catholic Answers. Mm-hmm. And so I hate to tell you, Google it, but Google it. The Catholics, because the church has been around for 2,000 years, they've thought through a lot of things. And so you could ask the Catholic Church, what should I have for lunch on Tuesday? And I'd say, brisket and orange soda because of this part of scripture or whatever. And so if you just Google it, Catholic Answers has taken a lot of the very popular questions and given a beautiful scriptural and church father analysis of how they've come to those answers. It's a wonderful resource, and the best part of it all, much like our eternal salvation, is it's free. It comes at a price that you can afford. So I recommend you check it out.
Okay, but nobody died to build Catholic Answers.
No,
somebody did die for our salvation.
That's so right. That's clarify. True. And but then he gave us all the Catholic answers. So
Kevin says, "Hey, Michael, fellow Catholic here. What are your thoughts on the traditional Latin Mass?"
I love it. I am.
Are
such
Are you
a fan.
Having a full Mass for the wedding ceremony?
We'll be doing so. My priest.
Is that? Did I say that right?
Yeah. Okay. My priest is one of the people who turned me on to the Catholic, or to the traditional Latin Mass. Mm-hmm. And he's a priest in New York, Father George Rutler. He's a phenomenal writer, and he's had television shows, and look up anything you can find of him. His writing has been very influential on the way that I think about things. And he does a New Yorker kind of Latin Mass, which is there's a lot of chanting, there's a lot of Latin, but, it kind of moves along. Sometimes the traditional Latin Mass, you'll hear like, Credo in unum. It's nice long chanting. In New York, we got places to be. You got to move it a little faster than that. I really love it. Some of the older Anglican rites are really good for this too. There's some chanting, there's some English, there's some Latin. And then you can get the Tridentine Mass in most cities in the country, if not all cities, which is the full, all in Latin, beautiful chanting. It's really nice because after Vatican II, you had a lot of acoustic guitars and, maracas or something, and the liturgy just suffered so much. Part of going to the Mass is you're participating in a ritual. There's a sacrament that's happening, the Eucharist. And what a sacrament is when heaven and earth touch one another, when the metaphysical and the physical touch one another, the symbol and the symbolized. It's not just a symbol. It's not just a symbol of Christ's sacrifice, and it's not literally a hunk of flesh. It's the two coming together in one, in a sacrament. And when you're in a beautiful liturgy, you're awed by that. That's the first feeling. The beginning of wisdom is fear of the Lord. The feeling that you have is one of awe and wonder and holy fear. And you don't always get that in the suburban churches with the electric guitars. Maybe you can, but not frequently. In my experience. So that traditional liturgy, if you haven't experienced it, you can even go to Eastern Orthodox. It doesn't have to just be a Catholic liturgy. I think the Eastern Orthodox, they have twice the liturgy and half the Pope. So that, those can be really, really beautiful. But I recommend you check it out because it's the experience of it, it puts your whole body into it. It's not just rationalism. It's not just abstraction. It really, we're a unified body and soul, and I think you see the unity of that in that traditional liturgy, and I hope it spreads more. It's on the rise in the United States, and I hope it just keeps going, because that That draws people into the pews.
Okay. Christian says, how will we ever resolve the problems in the Middle East?
Bombs. A lot of bombs would be a good way
or
to do
Jesus
it.
Or Jesus coming
big.
Back. That's,
yeah, that's, and the coming saying. Age. Yeah. Well, right. I mean, the real answer, you give a real answer, which is that the problems in the Middle East will not be resolved until the end of the age and the second coming. Probably that's true. One, because politics is the affairs of men and those mm-hmm. things don't change. Two, because the problems in the Middle East have been going on since Cain and Abel, since, you know, the second generation of people. And because there is, on the one hand, we cannot just uproot and transplant American ideals mm-hmm. and install them perfectly in other places. Doesn't mean that we can't try to use our influence and use our ideas to bring people up to speed. But the conservative disposition is one that says you can't just abstract everything and make everything universal like the Enlightenment tried to do. That doesn't quite work. People have traditions and rituals and family relationship and long antagonisms between clans and different kins and tribes and things like that. And you're never going to utterly eradicate that. So I would say if you're sitting around and you're waiting for the Middle East conflict to be resolved, don't hold your breath. If you're speaking specifically, though, of Israel and Palestine, Palestine, that's the country to the east of Wakanda and to the west of Narnia, the country of Palestine. If you're talking about that specifically, then this administration has done a wonderful job because in the old days, I got you on that one.
That was actually kind of funny. Sorry, continue.
In the old days, you know, in the Clinton administration, the Obama administration, they would treat these terrorists, these Palestinian terrorists, on the same level as they would treat the duly elected leaders of Israel. That's absurd. There is no country called Palestine. The Palestinian people elected Hamas to be their governing body in 2006. Those people don't get a country. And if we pretend, if we go along with this fantasy and this fiction that there is a country of Palestine and that somehow Israel is occupying their territory, you certainly won't have peace. You'll get more chaos, more war, more death. We need to be very clear. Clarity helps bring about peace. There is a country called Israel. They have a right to their territory. The capital of Israel is Jerusalem. Our embassy is now in Jerusalem. And people that elect Hamas to be their government, they don't get to have a country.
Okay. Devin says, Big Mike. I mean, not the word I would use to describe you, but okay. Big Mike.
Who's your personality.
Who's your covfefe dealer? And can you hook me up? I'm in dire need of a fix.
All right. I got a big confession to make. This is why I'm a little sick right now. I deal. So reach me on Twitter. I'll talk to you. I deal covfefe. Uh-huh. I dish it out all day long, but I taste my own product.
Oh.
And that's gotten me into some trouble these last couple weeks because I just can't resist. I got all that covfefe. I'm trying to dish it out to people here on Twitter, on the show.
Is it recreationally legal here in California or?
It's banned recreationally, medically. You cannot have covfefe in California. But the last couple days I've been like Tony Montana. I've just been sitting there and I say, oh, and I dip my face in the covfefe and I blow up a big bunch of covfefe up my nose. It's a hell of a drug. So the long story short is DM me. I'll hook you up.
Moving on. Joshua, Sir Michael of covfefe. Who has the best President Trump impersonation at the Daily Wire?
Do I venture it now? This is very hard.
Because Ben's, I love Ben like a brother, but his impersonations are real bad.
Well, you know, some are better than others. He does, I think he gets the Obama inflection very well.
Chris Matthews is good.
That's my favorite one.
Keith Olbermann is good.
Yeah. Trump
can actually
do
Pierce Morgan, too, pretty well.
Well, you figure if you just destroy a man on national television and ruin his career, you know something about him. Yeah. You could do the impression. I will say Ben's impression of Trump is much better than Alec Baldwin's terrible impression of Trump. The thing with, there are different kinds of Trump because you get the Trump.
Prompter Trump?
Yeah. And you also, some are high, some are low. You get like, okay, frankly, and it's the airy Trump. But then sometimes Trump is very like on his voice, right? Like, we will make America great again, okay? Okay, folks, we're gonna do it, folks. We're gonna do it. And those are two different shades of Trump. And you know, an impression is not an impersonation. It gives you just a little idea of Trump. So maybe I think our various impressions of Trump
The perfect one.
It's altogether the perfect one, but it gets to how we see the man. You know, they get to different.
I can see that.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that. maybe Alec Baldwin's impersonation of Trump is so bad because he views only the bad of the man.
Yeah, and he's just terrible at doing impressions. Yeah, there's also that. Good actor, though.
ABC's giving him a Sunday night show. A talk show. That guy.
Did you ever, I have to say, I can't believe I'm plugging his stupid podcast. He used to have this podcast, Alec Baldwin, on, I think it was NPR, and it was like a caricature of an NPR podcast.
That's amazing.
It was called Here's the Thing. And he goes, "Hi, I'm Alec Baldwin. And here's the thing." You just think, how are you keeping a straight face? It was an awful podcast.
My favorite Alec Baldwin moment of all time is when I worked for the Great American Sean Hannity. Let me segue for a moment. And he was on a show on WBC, and Mark Levin and Sean Hannity called in, and they were all just yelling at each other. And it's the best, most epic talk radio on the face of the planet.
That's just like Firing Line, you know?
It's
just
so good. Joel says, what's the best resource to figure out who to vote for during the primary season?
I use Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Mo on the California ballot because my vote doesn't really matter here. So I actually do. The other day, I was looking at the California primary ballot, and it was all these Democrats running for whatever. And then one of the people running is a bus driver. He was running for Secretary of State or something. He was a Republican. And I thought, like, oh, no, he was running for Senate against Dianne Feinstein.
Oh, okay.
And I thought, yes, I would much rather vote for any bus driver in this entire country than Dianne Feinstein. So I put that there. There were some good resources out there. If you want to find out for conservatives, a lot of different outlets, Club for Growth, Conservative Review, a few other places put out scorecards. Mm-hmm. Take it a little bit with a grain of salt because these organizations have their priorities. So an A-plus from the Club for Growth is going to be a different than an A-plus from the NRA, for instance. But I would check out those scorecards because they're very good. The reason that we have lobbying in this country, other than that it's enshrined in our First Amendment, is because we don't have the time to become experts on every topic in politics. Mm-hmm. So we need people who are experts to give us the highlights, give us the executive memo. I usually check it out that way. And there is a little bit go with your gut on certain candidates because politics is not just about everyone's position on issues. It's also about the ethos. It's also about the spirit of a person. If they're going to fight, if they're going to change their minds, if they're going to, you know, for instance, on the question of moving the embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, everybody promised that they would do it. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, everyone always promises, none of them do it. Trump promised, I expected he wouldn't do it, just like everyone else. And then he did it because he's a different type of politician than those other guys. You need to know with the people you're voting for, are they the kind of politician who's actually going to follow through on their word? Or if they say this, it really means this. So you got to go with your gut a little bit there. But use all of those resources on the issues because those people have done the research that you don't have time to do.
Okay. Norm says, do you find Jordan Peterson's attempts to rephrase conservative and religious wisdom in secular materialistic terms to be a valuable project? Or is too much lost in his attempted translation of it?
I do think it's a very valuable project. I've had Jordan on the show a couple times, and I have tried to baptize him both times. I've tried to, because I do find in Jordan's writing that he's speaking about Christ. He is speaking about Jesus. And I know that's not fashionable, and I know that's not sophisticated in today's culture to say that. It's much more sophisticated to say, well, he's getting to the idea of the divine that is evoked in our consciousness and the way that language is a... Right, Bob, okay, sure. That's the more sophisticated way. But the more precise way is he's reaching for Jesus. And that's a little frustrating when he won't go all the way and I try to throw water on him through the camera or through the Skype set. But what he's doing is so incredibly important because what he is doing is he is engaging a whole array of people who have been brought up with this stupid idea of atheism, this idea that is not philosophically tenable. There are not good arguments for atheism. And he's going in and getting them like a gateway drug to say there's purpose in life, life has meaning, you should clean your room, there is objective truth. He's going through and setting people up to the point where I think they can take in theology or philosophy. And I don't know that someone who isn't a mild-mannered psychologist from Canada could do that right now. I think he might be the perfect entry point. I say this all the time. People say, Michael, you're a Catholic, so do you think that we should eradicate all of these different Protestant speakers or this or that? I don't think so at all. I've loved reading Protestant speakers. They brought me away from atheism and brought me into a fuller understanding of the church. I then went further. I then went further theologically than many of those writers would be willing to do. But you need those gateway drugs. I don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Hmm. If people read Jordan Peterson and they are imbued with these thoughts of truth, objective morality, those kind of things, awesome. That guy deserves sainthood.
All right. We only have a few minutes left, so let's keep rolling through as many questions as possible. Tommy says, hey, Michael, are we going to see a return to the panel of deplorables on your show? I liked watching an actual panel of sane people not yelling over each other.
Well, it's very hard because, as you know, I'm getting married, so bringing on a bunch of cute ladies, present company excluded, included, every day on my show, you know, that can create some tensions at home.
Uh-huh.
No, I'd love to bring the panel back. We've had...
You could just start booking some dudes, too.
What?
I'm just saying, some guys...
I don't know. No, I'm talking about the panel.
Some guys actually have, like, decent political thoughts. Not many, but I'm saying you don't just need ladies like myself
this
on the
is,
panel.
No, okay, so I see the confusion.
Uh-huh.
What you... Because you're on there, you're giving your thoughts. It's very interesting for the audience. But when the ladies are on the panel, usually I'm just there, you know, I'm just sort of staring, you know, like kind of mindlessly. So that's, I had to stop that for my own.
Okay.
And there's also Paul Cardinal Bois who would come on, I guess.
Yes.
His eminence.
From the Vatican.
Yeah, live from the Vatican. Mm-hmm. No, I love doing the panel. We switched it up a little bit because I wanted to do some of these longer interviews, which I've been doing on the show in the last month or two. But we tried to bring them back recently for a show. And I think this was Satan's fault. All of the tech broke down, and so I lost everyone who was on the panel. We couldn't do it. But we're going to try to do it again soon, because I do love getting everyone's opinion, and those guys are all my pals. You know, I did a Fox hit on Sunday, and Ali Stuckey was one of the
Ali
people.
You, Ali Stuckey, and then...
And Charlie Kirk was on there. And I thought, oh, Ali, oh, man, I haven't seen you on camera since. This is like the panel of deplorables, but on Fox News. So we got to do it again. We'll bring it back.
All righty. Jacob says, hey, Michael, young Christian here with an ecology degree. This field is based in a lot of controversial science, such as climate change. How do I keep my credibility?
Well, I suppose it is a little controversial because it's all these lefties and materialist types there. One place where they go wrong with climate change, because I think so much of the conversation of climate change is incoherent, and it's really people having theological debates and pretending that they're having a scientific debate. So if there is a question, is the Earth warming somewhat? I don't know, possibly. I talked to Richard Lindzen about this, former atmospheric physicist at MIT, and he said there might be some evidence that it's warming slightly. There isn't a lot of evidence that it would be catastrophic. There's some evidence it could be beneficial. The models are insufficient, and they've always been wrong, so who knows? And I think what people are really having with climate change is a substitute for religion, because everybody's got to serve somebody. So when you don't have true religion...
Bob Dylan
said the great prophet of the previous age. When you don't have true religion, you have to worship other things. You get superstitious. So climate change gives you all of this, right? It gives you a sin in the form of pollution. You can even buy indulgences in the form of carbon tax credits. So it has all, you worship the sun god, basically. You worship the earth and the creation, which is why it's an unsatisfying religion, because you're worshiping the creation instead of the creator. But there are plenty of places for good Christians in studying the heavens and how the heavens go and our own earth. St. Francis of Assisi wrote a beautiful piece to Sister Earth, not Mother Earth, Sister Earth. And I think Pope Francis used a quote of that in an apostolic exhortation. So many of the great physical advances in science have been made, in many of them, by Catholic priests and by Christians broadly. So I think that's good. You have to make sure you don't fall for the trap of worshiping the creature rather than the creator. And you have to make sure when people are having these debates that you're really debating science and you're not seeing emails circulating around East Anglia University saying, we have to hide the decline because our faith hinges on it practically. No, you go where the data tell you that the science is going. And if you worship something else, I think you'll be able to keep a level head about that, even as your atheist colleagues cannot keep a level head.
Okay. Norm says, are you and Andrew Klavan ever going to have a conversation on your different views of beauty, subjective versus objective? I suspect this may play a major part in your different views on marriage.
Could be. I don't know. I think that sometimes when you give these 3-second answers, then sometimes minor differences or nuances seem to be opposing
bigger
views.
Bigger than they are.
Bigger than they are. So I will say in C.S. Lewis, said, I think in The Weight of Glory, I always confuse all the Lewis books. Somewhere C.S. Lewis said he was writing about, maybe it was Abolition of Man, one of those two, said that the tree is beautiful. And it's not your feeling of the tree that is beautiful. Your feeling could be beautiful or your feeling could be whatever. But the tree itself is beautiful. And because the tree is beautiful, you perceive that it is beautiful. And that's objectivity. And I think somewhere Drew may have said that it is your observing the tree that makes it beautiful. And of course, what he's saying there is that it is our consciousness that is able to process the beauty of the tree. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the same thing as saying, you know, it's just my feelings, man. I don't know if it's quite that. So
I don't know that Drew makes any decision based on, you know, that's just my feelings.
Yeah, definitely not since he was at Berkeley, you know, not since his hippie days. So I don't really think it's quite that. And also, when it comes to marriage, I think Drew is making certain Aristotelian arguments, and Christianity is infused with Aristotle. Aristotle comes up through St. Thomas Aquinas. And so that might have some nuance there as well. But I think it would be very unfair to the Supreme Lord of the Multiverse to say that he is some relativist who says, you know, don't yuck my yum. I think I just really, my feels are all beautiful, man. I don't think it's quite that. I think that distinction is overstated.
All right. Keegan says, what's a simple way to explain the conflict in Israel? To me and my friend are having a small argument over this.
Oh, well, you should read the Bible and read the Quran, and I think you'll get it. If you
actually
just take the
Dennis
time.
Prager has a good video on that too over at PragerU.
The Israel, yeah. The real conflict is that people don't want the Jews to have a homeland. They don't want the Jews to have Israel. That's the central part of it. And ever since the establishment of the State of Israel, people have been trying to invade and conquer it and deny and chisel away the land from Israel. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, does the State of Israel have the right to its own country in its historical homeland? And all of the questions that have to do with that will come out from there. Someone pointed out, they said, Palestinians are the philological descendants of the Philistines. You know, that's the word comes from Philistine to Palestinian. But the Philistines had their homeland and the Jews shouldn't take it. But it is worth pointing out the Philistines are invaders. So I'd read parts of history and scripture. That's the central question. Do the Jews have the right to their homeland in their historical homeland? I think so. I would much rather have the only functioning ally of the United States, functioning democracy in the Middle East, in Israel, the Jewish state, rather than another failed country, as has happened with so many of the neighbors of Israel.
All right, back to cultural question real quick. Right. Raymond says, speaking on movies and TV, why do we hire all these foreigners to play Americans with American accents when we have tons of undiscovered talent?
I hope you're talking about a little old me. Because these days, the only acting work that I get is in Another Kingdom and Ted Cruz commercials. Those are my main venues as an actor these days. I think part of this is because a lot of modern acting training in America is hucksterism. Hmm. And there are still a few good teachers. I could recommend them to you, but really only a few that I could recommend. Mm-hmm. And I think most of them are in New York. The trouble with acting in the post-Brando world, especially with kids today, is that Marlon Brando was innovative, mm-hmm. as were all of the teachers of the group theater and Stella Adler and Sanford Meisner and Strasberg as well. Yeah. And there was this triumph of naturalism, mm-hmm. in acting. So you had Marlon Brando would start to mumble a little bit or start to chew his words, and it wasn't that perfect diction of, say, Laurence Olivier or something. And this all comes from Freud, basically, from Stanislavski, from Freud, from Duse's blush. The actress Eleonora Duse blushed on stage because her subconscious was working so much in the character. She was so embodying the character that an unconscious response of a blush was able to come out. And modern actors in America have taken this far too far, and they don't make any choices. They just sort of stand there and mumble because they think any choice is not naturalistic. Hmm. But that isn't true. There's nothing, as Stella Adler said, there's nothing natural about boring the audience to death. There's nothing organic about boring your audience to death. And so you see much better actors come in, and they can make choices from overseas. There also just aren't great roles for certain demographics. So there's like one role for black people every year. There are a lot of great black actors. So on average, the black performance in America is much better. I think that's one of the reasons why. And we have more of a celebrity culture, whereas there is still that classical theatrical tradition in London. If you're going to be a British actor, there's a good chance you really want to do the craft rather than just get insta famous and put Kardashians in movies or something.
And be able to charge $1 million per post.
Right.
Yeah. Julian says, Miguel, in summary, what are the pillars of Catholicism that brought you back to the church? Can you do this in a minute or less?
I could probably sum up 2,000 years in a minute or less.
In an auctioneer tone. Go.
There's a question of moral authority. So the question is the Pope the Pope? Is the church the church? Did Christ institute a church on earth? Did he say to Peter, Peter, you are the rock, and on this rock I will build my church? Did he say, you have the keys to the kingdom of heaven? Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Feed my sheep. Do you love me? Do you love me? Feed my sheep. Did he instruct, did the risen Lord instruct the apostles for 40 days on how to build the church and tell them where to go and tell them how to go and tell them to sell their cloaks and buy a sword and tell them to go here or there, tell Peter where he was going to die? Was there an understanding of the early church community in the apostolic age, in the early ecumenical councils? Was there an understanding of succession and where certain churches, say the bishopric of Alexandria, they would look to the bishop of Rome to resolve certain disputes? Has that evolved over time? Is the church a living institution? And is a sacrament a sacrament? Is a sacrament the meeting of heaven and earth, the metaphysical and the physical, in the real institution of the church? If our God-man, unlike all of these other religions, if the divine logos of the universe came down and became a man, enfleshed himself, and really died for our sins, chose particular people at a particular place at a particular time to be his apostles and to spread the good news, then does he have a particular church in real space and time? And it seems to me the answer is clearly yes. And what springs from that is the only theology and institution that has endured for the entire history of Christendom, Christianity.
All right. We're done.
All right.
Here we go.
A real easy question to end on. Defend the 2,000-year-old faith. Yeah, okay, good.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Michael, for being here this month. We'll see you in a couple of months. Or, you know, tomorrow over on the Michael Knoll Show.
Right.
You can subscribe to thedailywire.com now, and then you can be a part of next month's episode of The Conversation on Tuesday, June 19th at 5:30 p.m. Eastern, 2:30 p.m. Pacific, and that's featuring our very own Ben Shapiro. I am Alicia Krauss.
I am Michael Knowles.
This was The Conversation with Michael Knowles, and we'll see you next month.
Cool.